Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Purrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing to talk about some of the things roiling our current political scene. But before we can move on, almost 2 years ago, we found out that the water in Flint was massively poisoned with lead because municipal officials preferred to save a few extra dollars regardless of the damage to human beings. The situation caused worldwide outrage and revealed a major crisis where over 2,000 localities around the country had excessive lead in the water, potentially affecting up to 6 million people. With all that spotlight, you'd think public officials in Michigan and the country at large would have done something about it by now. Well, you thought wrong. 2 years on and the water in Flint can still not be drunk safely from the tap, and only marginally more safely from expensive water filters that have to be frequently changed. While there is free bottled water available, it can only be picked up at certain distribution centers, and there's difficulties for many residents. As journalist Bryce Covert points out some of the difficulties, saying, quote, while there are 5 distribution centers that give out free water, residents are limited to 1 case per household. Lines can stretch for hours, and some residents don't have the strength to haul water cases. Plus, many people in the city lack adequate transportation to get to distribution centers in the first place, as 19% of residents don't have access to a car. There are free buses, but the plaintiffs, and she means in a lawsuit around this, allege that they run infrequently and don't have convenient enough routes to help many people, end quote. So you might think, why not just deliver the water? Well, that's what some residents thought, and they brought a lawsuit about a week and a half ago. A federal judge agreed with them and required that Flint establish a delivery service. But get this, the state of Michigan is fighting it on appeal, claiming that the costs are too high. The cost for clean water is just too high, they say. No doubt they missed the irony in that explanation. Meanwhile, in Congress, the government is still debating 2 measures in the House and Senate to provide funds to help rebuild Flint's water infrastructure. While they debate the exact dollar amount for the House and Senate that have appropriated it, they have to reconcile it. It's also worth noting that Congress overall is spending about $975 billion less than it needs to make sure everyone has clean water over the next 25 years. Which you should find pretty worrisome, given that 60 schools in Cleveland just recently found dangerous levels of lead in the water. And in San Francisco, a recent report noted 94% of the homes have some sort of lead in the water. And since no amount of lead in water is safe, even when it's below the threshold for a government emergency, people are still being poisoned. And as we've reported before on this show, Western New York right now is also experiencing a major rash of reports of poisoned water in schools all across that region. So, while a substance that can cause serious developmental disabilities in children is coursing through our water systems and then their veins, Congress argues over whether to help Flint get clean water, Michigan state officials are shirking their responsibility, and millions of us continue to be exposed to a dangerous poison on an everyday basis. Over the weekend, the ongoing struggle between water protectors and police acting as private security guards for the Dakota Access Pipeline flared again. Sunday night, police used fire hoses on protesters in 20-degree below weather to prevent them from reopening a bridge police had closed to prevent protests. But that has also been hobbling the ability of those on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation to access their homes and impeded the ability of emergency vehicles to make it on the reservation as well. Police closed the bridge as part of a broader and brutal crackdown to clear the protest encampment closest to the construction. In addition to potentially causing hypothermia among hundreds of protesters by using their water cannons, on Sunday night, cops in Standing Rock used concussion grenades, pepper spray, and rubber bullets as well. Since the original clearing of the first encampment, the police maintained a military-like presence, and the National Guard is present there, as well as gangs of armed thugs, and have continued to brutally repress peaceful demonstrators to make sure work on the pipeline can continue. However, it isn't all bad news on the Dakota Access Pipeline front. Norway's largest bank, DNB, sold its assets in the Dakota Access Pipeline over the weekend. While this is a sale and thus not a fatal blow to the project itself, it's a clear reflection that the ongoing protests are making this an investment that some feel is becoming too hot to handle. Activists have been increasingly targeting major financial institutions in an attempt to force them to divest from the pipeline project. So as the repression increases, so does the resistance. Go to sacredstonecamp.org and find out how you can help. And in some other environmental news, there are 12,000 schools that are within a mile of a hazardous chemical facility. That means that 1 in 10 children, almost 5 million, are going to a school that is within a mile of a chemical facility with materials that could kill them. These chemical sites are serious enough that they are all required by law to have contingency plans in place for potential spills given the hazards. If that wasn't bad enough, another similar study looked at the number of schools that are close to high-volume emitters of toxic chemicals, bad enough to cause respiratory and neurological problems in children. And they found that, quote, thousands of schools and hundreds of thousands of children are at risk, end quote, of being exposed. And for instance, 17 high-volume emitters of neurotoxins have a school within half a mile. That number jumps to 43 if you expand the radius to a mile. 17 high-volume emitters of mercury also have schools within a half-mile radius, 34 when you take it out to a mile. And these spills and leaks happen all the time. Pam Nixon from West Virginia's Kanawha Valley told journalists at Truthout that in her area of the state with many chemical plants in it, they hear emergency sirens once a month. In August of this year in New Martinsville, West Virginia, a chlorine gas leak caused evacuations of whole communities. And of course, as you might suspect, there are no federal regulations on how close chemical sites like this must be from schools. Lead in the water, chemicals in the air, and a government that prefers to defend dangerous oil pipelines rather than access to life's most precious resource. There's your snapshot of America in 2016. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here to continue the conversation by Ben Dixon from The Benjamin Dixon Show, Ben Norton, who's a columnist with Salon.com, and Marcus Farrell, a political strategist, organizer, and the former African-American outreach director for Bernie Sanders. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Of course. And Ben Norton, I will start with you with some of the, I guess, hot news coming into this week, which is another big explosive weekend in Standing Rock. You wrote a column on Friday called Palestinians Support Indigenous Dakota Pipeline Protest, which I thought was quite interesting. So, I mean, I wonder, do you think with this escalation here that we've seen over the weekend that this Standing Rock struggle could become not only one of the bigger sites of resistance in America, but perhaps worldwide? Help drive more of a movement?
Well, it's clear that inside the U.S., it's already become one of the largest activist movements going on now. It's incredibly symbolic. And then globally, in many ways, it kind of already is. I mean, to answer your question directly, as I mentioned, and I reported this week on, or last week rather, on a video and an open letter created by a Palestinian group in Gaza expressing solidarity with indigenous protesters leading the people who identify as water protectors leading the demonstrations in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is a $2.8 billion, nearly 1,200-mile oil pipeline that would transfer oil across six states. So, yeah, I mean, it's become a very important issue. We've seen activists not just from the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, but from the Movement for Black Lives, from the Environmental Justice Movement, and from a variety of other movements that have come to express solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. So this really is an issue that kind of embodies the way in which all of these forms of oppression intersect. You have the issue of environmental justice, you have the issue of racial justice, you have the issue of indigenous rights and liberation. And seeing the solidarity from around the world has been amazing.
Well, and Ben Dixon, let me ask you this question, because I think that, you know, historically when people talk about, you know, quote unquote environmentalism, the climate justice movement, it's described, and I don't think this is always fully true, but nevertheless true enough, that it was sort of a middle class white movement. And it seems like with Standing Rock, things have really taken a leap. I mean, not only do we have the leadership coming from the Native Nations, but as Ben points out, it's become a site of solidarity from people from so many different struggles going out there. I mean, does you think Standing Rock has something maybe of an inflection point kind of moment in the progressive movement in America, where it's bringing together people across lines in ways perhaps that in the past we didn't see?
Yeah, I think I have to agree with that. And it really stems from this idea of environmental racism, something that is a fairly new concept in terms of our day-to-day discourse, but it's something that has affected people of color for many, many generations. I mean, the Dakota Access Pipeline was originally scheduled to go through an entirely different neighborhood, so to speak, and they protested against it and got it now through the Native American land, sacred land, tribal lands there. So it clearly shows you intersection of race and all the different components, race as well as environmental justice. And I think this is a perfect opportunity in the midst of this storm for us to find that solidarity and move forward on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a great point. And I think, Marcus, I also wonder, you know, what's your take on, and I'll swing back around to ask other people this too, but I mean, what's your take on how this is going to affect the strategy we're seeing coming from the Democrats, you know, right now in regards to Trump, where they're saying, well, you know, we'll work with him on some issues, but you know, when it comes to like racism and bigotry or whatever, we won't work with him at all. But like, here's an issue where you have a quote unquote infrastructure issue. I mean, building pipelines and stuff like that, Republicans consider that infrastructure, jobs issue or whatever, but one where it clearly contradicts with, you know, the rights of Native people and broader issues around climate or whatever. I mean, does that sort of say that what we're hearing a lot from the Sanders camp, the Warren camp, Chuck Schumer, these other people in terms of how they're going to work together with Trump, that the center can't really hold there in terms of trying to balance these competing agendas?
We're at a place right now where, the left is the movement and the availability and the strength and the momentum of the left, Sanders wing and the Elizabeth Warren wing. Oh, we're starting to take over conversations, and sooner or later the whole center conversation is just going to have to absolutely move left, or you're going to be on Trump's side. Trump is going to occupy a lot of space, and if Trump was as smart as I start hearing a lot of mumbling about, you know, Trump reached out to Tulsi Gabbard this morning. I understand it's supposed to have a meeting with her. So that'll be interesting to see if he's going to try to take some of that momentum from the left and put it a part of his administration to nullify the arguments from this side of the aisle. So we're going to start seeing a very interesting place where I think Trump is going to try to just create a movement around the anti-establishment folks on the left and the right. That's a very dangerous thing, whether you like them or not. And then the establishment folks are going to have to figure out where they fit in and then kind of double down on the rhetoric that they're currently using. So we're in for an interesting first 100 days, obviously, of his administration, and to see exactly what side of the aisle or what side of the fence that folks end up on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ben Dixon, I'll come back to you with the same question. I mean, is there a potential contradiction here? I think what Marcus is saying is right. I mean, if Trump can become sort of a realignment president and try to tap the anti-establishment sentiment on both sides, it seems like if he's going to try to do that, though, the big loser is going to be a stronger focus on sort of building sort of the if you want to use this term, intersectionality between how we view class, race, gender, or whatever, into a critique that can move forward against, you know, the real Wall Street corporate America.
Yeah, it goes underneath, and I think Trump is also going underneath this assumption that, I hate to say tokenism, it is great that he's going to speak to someone from the left, whether it was a woman of color, a man of color, whatever the case may be, someone who's, but it really puts a problem in front of the rest of us, right? And that problem is something that I honestly think we already have the answer to. Are we satisfied with having a representation of our interests at the table, and are we satisfied enough to where we'll be silent on the other issues, which is an absolutely resounding no, right? So even if he brings in someone who's going to discuss class, even if he brings someone who's anti-establishment into his campaign, that doesn't mean it's going to silence our voices as we fight vigorously against all of the other things that he's putting on the table, because as he's trying to solidify this base that's inclusive of everyone who's anti-establishment, that also puts us in league with neo-Nazis. It puts us in league with the Steve Bannons of the world and all of the other people he's bringing to the table. So, yeah, we can work with you when you're right, Trump, but we're actually going to give you quite hell on everything else.
Mm-hmm. Ben Norton, we got a couple minutes left before our first break. What do you think on this question?
Well, I agree with the sentiments that have been expressed, and I think that something that needs to be voiced is the danger of this attempt, as Marcus said, to build a coalition or to attempt to build a coalition between so-called establishment elements. Because what does the establishment mean? I mean, people claim that Trump is anti-establishment, but this is a right-wing extremist. This is a billionaire who is on the Fortune 500 list. This is a white supremacist. This is a misogynist. These are all very establishment tendencies. And I fail to see it really in any way how he's anti-establishment. He's opposing mainstream elements of the Republican Party, but he's moving it further and further to the right. And I think we need to be very careful about Bannon in particular. Bannon is a very smart guy. He's a strategist. He's been, you know, involved in politics for years now, and he knows where he's headed. And he's made a lot of subtle comments that many people who aren't trained to recognize far-right symbols and cues might not recognize. But, you know, this is a guy who is very far on the right. He's a white supremacist. He did an interview recently in which he said, it's a very exciting time to live right now. He said he was an economic nationalist. He opposed being called a white nationalist, even though he is one. And he claimed he is an economic nationalist. And then he said, this is an exciting time like the 1930s. So we have a guy who's in the White House, who's the right-hand man of Trump, and who's saying that he's an economic nationalist and comparing the time to the 1930s, the classic years of fascism.
Wow. Well, that tells you a little bit of what you need to know on that. Well, I think that's a great point. We're going to come back after this break with a lot more, so we'll come back to some of these points. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing to talk about a little bit of what's next for progressives, how people in Congress who claim to be progressives may or may not be working with the Trump administration, how the protests on the streets are going to play out in terms of movement building, and I'm sure much, much more. And we continue to be joined by Ben Dixon from The Ben Dixon Show, Ben Norton, who writes at Salon.com, among other things, and Marcus Farrell, who is a political strategist and organizer and worked on the Sanders campaign. So, gentlemen, I want to just keep it rolling here. And Ben Dixon, I'll start with you on this because I think, you know, to me, looking at what's happening here, and I think especially in terms of, what Ben Norton was laying out just towards the end of the last segment in terms of being very careful about how people, progressives on the left and so on and so forth, build alliances, is these protests that have been happening against Trump. I mean, you know, I'm usually sort of a net positive person on all sort of progressive protests, better for people to be doing something rather than nothing. But, you know, I wonder. Obviously, there is the initial piece was just a knee-jerk reaction. But if this is going to really deepen into some sort of resistance, where does this movement need to go? What are some of the things it needs to start highlighting, do you think?
So which protest, right? So the first thing that I was surprised at was that it was quite a diverse group of groups that were protesting from. Some of them were the disillusioned Hillary Clinton supporters who couldn't imagine a system working against them, which is quite ironic, but I'll leave them alone. Then there was another group that had been protesting Trump for a long time based on his racism and nationalism. I would say to both groups, what we need to do moving forward is to simultaneously work out our differences and find some resolution on the issue that we have outstanding, because we still have a fight on the left that is very loud and very present, and we have to address those things so that we can, with one voice, fight against all these things that Donald Trump is doing. I don't think we need to wait until we've resolved our differences, because that might take 4 years. Mm. But we definitely need to address them as we go and fight against Trump.
Well, and let me ask you this as a follow-up. I mean, say a little bit more about that. I mean, what do you think some of the key fault lines that perhaps we should at least acknowledge, if not find a full solution to move towards a greater unity?
Yeah, 100%. It's the difference between, I hate to use this word, but it's the fact, neoliberal multiculturalism, right? It's this not willing to address class so long as we put a nice person of color on top of the issue, right? So long as we have a person of color, a woman of color, a trans person of color that's leading a corporation, then we're okay instead of addressing all of the ills that that corporation and the effects that they're having on the poor communities, right? It's whether or not we're going to simultaneously address race and class, not either or, both and. And we really have tremendous pushback from some leading journalistic voices that are trying to marginalize a conversation on class and race. They want it to be simply race, or identity. And that's to the detriment of the entire progressive movement. And I think that's part of what backfired and pushed Trump into the White House.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point. And Marcus, I'll turn it to you because, I mean, it is sort of, being able to walk and chew gum at the same time sort of situation. I mean, I think yourself, people like Ben, people like Anoa Chango, people who I was following during the election, the primary election, were, you know, essentially sort of raising this point in response to a lot of critiques of, you know, Bernie Sanders and what he may or may not have been doing, that, you know, the two things, class, race, whatever, aren't mutually exclusive, that we can sort of build sort of a new understanding. So, I mean, I just wonder what you think a little bit about what Ben is saying in terms of the need to reconcile these things on a movement building level.
Yeah, well, first I want to address the protest. I think we ought to be very careful with where these protests are going. I mean, I'm concerned personally that the next time a African-American unarmed person gets shot by a police officer and, you know, that the current protest, which might not yield any results because Trump is still going to be president, I don't want the current protest to take away from the protests that are in the streets around the movement for Black Lives. But that's neither here nor there. It's all about solutions. And I also think that we need to start thinking more about doing outreach instead of doing protests. We need to take our energy to door to door, house to house, conversation to conversation about how we can actually have some tangible changes instead of kind of sort of yelling out. We need to be a little bit more strategic about how we do, how we release our anger. When it comes down to rectifying the situation between the Democratic Party, Ben is absolutely right. They do not want to, a lot of folks do not want us to have conversation about class. And even to the point where they will utilize, some organizations will utilize Black voices, Latino voices at the top of their organizations and keep the proper funding that actually goes out to outreach and communication and conversations within these Latino, Black, and, you know, and urban areas and not in poor white areas from happening. And it's sort of to keep the money into the pockets of TV consultants and big time radio consultants and the folks who are making all the money in DC. We have a class conversation within the party that needs to change. You know, you get pure voices from the organizers on the street, but the organizers on the street aren't the same folks that are doing the $2 million, $10 million television buys. At the core of it, that's where the money is going. That's the money conversation. It's about outreach. It's about who's in the room and having these conversations. And when you look at the current, when you look at the current environment of who has the money that actually dictates where the party goes and where the movement goes, you look around that room, it's pretty much all white faces. And until those things change, and white rich faces, until those things change where you have a diverse group of folks who are having conversations about the outreach, who know what it's like to be in the streets, who know what it's like to do the organizing in the streets, that's when you start seeing the party going in the right direction. Up until that point, it's starting to look like we're going to be at a stalemate sooner or later because folks are not going to cede power, and then the super left are not going to just give up.
You know, I wonder what your general thoughts are on this, Ben Norton, as well, because to me, one of the most ironic things about this whole controversy, and I think the divide, Ben Dixon laid it out quite well, is that, you know, the Black community, the Latino community, the trans community, for that instance, 50% unemployment in that community, are like very heavily, and I would say compared to most white people, disproportionately working class. So, I mean, it's sort of a weird irony that the two things are counterposed when many of these sort of oppressed communities that people are raising up to be like, well, it's not just about class, are the ones that have the most class exploitation amongst them. So I don't know what your general comments and thoughts are on this conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said from all of you so far. Insightful discussion. I mean, I would say the irony is many people who say they're intersectional, right? Like we were talking earlier about intersection of oppressions. People who say they're intersectional sometimes are wary of discussing class because of the idea that if you discuss class, you're supposedly class reductionist and an economistic and not concerned with other forms of oppression. And I think there has been a very intentional campaign to remove class from the discussion. If you look at the rise of neoliberalism since the 1980s and 90s, especially since the rise of the so-called New Democrat under President Bill Clinton, there has been a move toward a discussion of forms of social injustices, which are absolutely important and, again, inextricably linked to economic ones. But then they've been trying to decouple that in any discussion. So you can talk about, you know, these other forms of social liberation, which are important. You can talk about the LGBT rights movement. You can talk about women's liberation. These are all incredibly important movements. We've seen huge gains, especially in fighting for LGBT rights in the past few decades. But at the same moment, economic inequality has gotten worse and worse and worse. 99% of the population globally controls more than 1%. 1% of the population globally controls more than 99%. You know, so things are getting worse and worse. Immiseration keeps getting worse. There's war after war. And then, of course, the irony, not only is this double standard applied to class and to economics and to the capitalist system, it's also applied to foreign policy and to war and imperialism. So, you know, many liberals who say they're intersectional and say they're concerned with these forms of oppression and don't talk about class also frequently don't talk about the, you know, military-industrial complex and, you know, the imperial systems that they live in which their democratic president, whom they admire, is bombing 7 Muslim-majority countries and has killed thousands of people and is backing an apartheid state in Israel and is supporting Saudi Arabia, one of the world's leading violators of human rights that refuses to allow women to drive. So that there's a degree of double standards here, and that's because those who challenge the capitalist system in particular and who challenge imperialism are the biggest threats of all. So I think there's been a very intentional campaign to prevent discussion of that.
No, I think that's a huge issue. And I want to ask your question on the same thing, Ben Dixon, because I feel like that is another Achilles heel that's out there. I mean, obviously there are many disagreements and things to discuss in the international sphere, but it's sort of a danger, I think, in sort of the quote unquote progressive politics to focus more on what people will refer to as the quote unquote sort of core economic issues domestically and just kind of abstract out things going on abroad. I mean, I personally believe that during the Obama administration, this was a huge, huge mistake in terms of people, for whatever reason, not really making strong concerted, well, many people did, but, you know, many so-called people who care about quote-unquote war and peace issues on drone strikes and other issues like that, and that, you know, for in so many different ways is so key, but that is something that we could be in danger of losing with people getting so caught up in the struggle against Trump and so on and so forth, you know, forgetting sort of the bipartisan nature of war and militarism.
Yeah, man, you said a mouthful there because that's the truth. And if I was to keep it 100, I would admit that I'm a person who had to evolve on international policy, right? Foreign relations. Not because I was a fan of Barack Obama, but Ben Norton puts that perfectly in context. That's what we have. We have people who love Obama so much that droning has to be okay because Obama is doing it. My problem is just my academic training in international relations, which pushes me towards realism, which gives me a grim outlook on the international stage. But you have to come to grips with that and look at the connections across the board, not only with the economic problems that we're facing here, but the usage of our military to expand America's empire, which is predominantly an economic phenomenon abroad. So you can't really address one without addressing the other. And we have this big gaping hole. I'm not willing to even address it because it's come at the tip of the spear of a Democratic president. Here's the opportunity and the challenge. The opportunity is in about 6 months, this is going to be 100% a Republican problem. All of a sudden, you're going to see people who never said anything about Obama and his droning program. You're going to see them finally giving some principled critique against Donald Trump. The challenge is, will they continue to give that principled critique once another Democratic president gets into office? I think if we don't start calling them on the carpet right now, we're going to see the same paradigm happen next time.
I think that's an interesting question. Marcus Farrell, get in on this conversation. I mean, what do you think in terms of connecting these international and domestic issues for progressive movement? Anything else you heard? Comment on that, too, please.
So our dear brother, Dr. Cornel West, when he was on the platform committee, you know, he made some very strong statements about making sure that the occupation, the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip was actually within the Democratic platform. And that's just another case of the division that's on the left, the Democratic side of the House. It's a very interesting thing when you think about one of Bernie Sanders' top surrogates and Bernie himself spoke about the occupation and adding that actually to the platform. And the opposition to that from, you know, establishment Democrats was a ferocious one and almost one of anger. Just so simply bringing up some issues surrounding Israel, surrounding the drone program on our side of the House is very faux pas. And I believe Ben hit the nail on the head where we have to call these guys to the carpet right now, call them to task to see if going forward they're going to be willing to push honesty and truth no matter who our leader is and hold folks accountable. And I think that's what the far left is asking for from our leadership.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ben Norton, let me ask you this question since Palestine came up as well. Some big protest over the last weekend by younger Jewish Americans against some of the hardcore Zionist organizations, Zionist Organization of America and others, also protest against Steve Bannon. I mean, that seems like somewhat of a significant development on the international stage there.
Absolutely. This is very interesting. And it's also something that is, for many of us, confirmation of what we've been warning about for years. You know, since 1978, since the so-called Menachem Begin Revolution, the rise of the right wing in Israel, the government has lurched further and further to the right. And in the past years, it has really plunged into the far right. We have a very extreme government in Israel right now. It's the most right wing in its entire history. Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, who is already very conservative, is kind of seen as a moderate now. And people like Naftali Bennett, Avigdor Lieberman, the new defense minister, called for beheading disloyal Palestinian citizens of Israel. So this is a very extreme government. The culture minister, Miri Regev, proudly in a TV interview said she's a fascist. So
wow.
There has been little discussion of this, but many Zionist groups in the U.S., even like pro, like soft, like liberal pro-Israel groups like J Street, which, you know, support the Democratic Party, but also are very pro-Israel, they have had to come to terms with this. And in the past few years under Obama, you know, Obama has issued some statements that have been critical, but otherwise he's let Israel expand illegal settlements and occupied land without any punishment, unlike President Bush Sr., for instance, who imposed sanctions on Israel. So the status quo has gotten worse and worse, and many liberal groups have been able to largely ignore it. But now that Trump is entering office, people can no longer ignore it. You have the Israeli government opening its arms to Trump and to his far-right camp. And more concerning of all, or most concerning of all, rather, is you see pro-Israel groups that are actively whitewashing the deep anti-Semitism of not just Breitbart and that the so-called alt-right crowd. You know, Steve Bannon, Trump's right-hand man, was the head of Breitbart News. And he's made anti-Semitic comments in the his website is far right and racist. And we've seen pro-Israel groups like Zionist Organization of America that have whitewashed and even defended Bannon and his ilk. Dershowitz, the lawyer who calls anyone who criticizes Israel anti-Semitic, he called the Black Lives Matter movement anti-Semitic. But then he also has now defended Bannon, who's an anti-Semite. So we see this incredible double standard here. And Jewish American groups, progressive young Jewish Americans, who have for years been protesting, you know, the extreme right-wing government in Israel and the oppression of the Palestinians, are now pointing out this intense hypocrisy. And last night, on Sunday night, Steve Bannon was invited to speak at the Zionist Organization of America gala, and he actually did not show up. Probably because of the big protest.
Well, we're going to have to take a break on that, but we're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing what's turned into quite a broad exploration of the political scene in the post-Trump world. We are joined by Ben Dixon from The Benjamin Dixon Show, Ben Norton, who writes for Salon.com, among other things, and Marcus Farrell, a political organizer, strategist, and formerly on the Bernie Sanders campaign. And gentlemen, I'll just keep going. And Ben Dixon, I'll start with you, because I think Ben Norton raising some of those issues in relationship to the Israel piece regarding Steve Bannon had me thinking, you know, what is your take on sort of the initial, I don't know what you want to call them, appointments by Donald Trump, some cabinet, some staff appointments? I mean, it seems like for the message he's been trying to send, well, I heard someone describe it like this. Trump campaigned as he was basically going to throw a brick through a plate glass window. So he had to come up with nominees that names would sound like the sound of breaking glass. And he's named a pretty interesting group of people so far. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's precisely correct, right? You can't get worse in terms of justice. You can't get worse in terms of torture. All of the things that he promised he was going to do, he's picking names, Jeff Sessions. Flynn, you know, Steve Bannon, of course. I mean, he's picking people to send a signal to his base that he's sensibly serious about everything that he said. The problem I think he's going to run into is that the pressure of their bigotry is going to cause them to implode. And so I think you're going to see a round of firings, mass firings. I don't know how much damage they're going to be able to do between now and then. They may be able to do a lot of damage. But I think it's not tenable. I can't imagine he can make it 4 years with some of these characters that he's chosen.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially you choose a guy named Michael Flynn, who the biggest knock against him, he's a terrible manager, and you make him the manager of the president's entire national security apparatus. But nevertheless, interesting question. Marcus Ferrell, what do you think? What's your first take on what looked to be a pretty hard right group of appointments by Trump there in the early days?
I mean, let's look at what he did on the campaign. I mean, that's basically the only version of management style we can get from him. Trump likes to surround himself by people he disagrees with. And I think once the pressure ratchets up from the far left side and the media starts calling out all of the things that they are going to try to attempt, Trump is a person who likes to win. And he will realize sooner or later, hopefully sooner, that he can't win with the crowd that he currently has around him. So he will make some changes. And let's not forget, I mean, he might be sending a signal to his base. But on the same token, with that being said, you know, he also understands that he's going to be galvanizing the left more and more. And I don't think that that's something that he wants. So my initial assessment of it is an unfortunate thing that he got Sessions from Alabama. I've worked in Alabama before. He is not a friend of people of color. He is not a friend of the working class, folks that are not white and not upper class. So we're in for a bumpy first 100 days. I'm gonna say that again. If Sessions and if Bannon decide to get their way, then they will take us back some years. Hopefully, Trump has a realization that that's not good for America, and we can go forward the right way.
Ben Norton, thoughts on the same issue?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's been articulated pretty well. I just think to interject another point that's pretty related. I mean, I think it's very important to build a movement. To build a movement left of the Democratic Party, because there's an attempt going on right now. Keith Ellison might become the new chair of the DNC. Bernie Sanders is probably going to join the party and become an important figure. And I think, you know, we should, at the same time, although, you know, that's an interesting development, I think we should also remember that the history of the Democratic Party has always been one of compromise. You know, people call the graveyard of social movements. So I think the responsibility of many progressives and people on the left should be pushing it continuously from the left and building that, you know, huge left flank. You know, there are a lot of people joining other socialist groups and organizations, and that's great. And I think, you know, when you look at the way politics works in the U.S. and you look at graphs that show different, you know, views and changes of opinion when you have a Democrat or a Republican enter office, you often see it completely flip. The Washington Post published a graph last week that showed that Republicans thought that the day before the election, the majority thought the economy was doing very badly. And then a day after the election, a majority thought the economy was doing well. And then it was exactly flipped for Democrats. So there's this kind of dogmatic partisanism, which I think is not, you know, it's very destructive politically. And I think people on the left should continue to push that and maintain that, you know, that critical perspective. As Ben said, I mean, if we have another Democratic president that enters office, if, you know, Trump ever leaves office, and I say that half jokingly, we should also, you know, be careful if there's another terrorist attack or, I mean, anything like that, he's going to probably push for more authoritarian measures. But the point is, we should make sure that we're consistent with our politics and not just allow all of this discontent to be pushed back into the Democratic Party so it can win a new election and then ask us to go back to our normal lives.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this follow-up too, Ben Norton. I mean, are you expecting, you mentioned this sort of obliquely, a growth in the explicitly socialist movement in this country in the course of all this turmoil?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, we've seen a variety of different socialist groups, that open socialist groups, that have seen huge membership increases in the past really week. You know, we've seen a lot of protests going on, led by socialist groups. And I think the Bernie Sanders campaign has done a good job of helping people, you know, many young people in particular, who previously were afraid of the S word or didn't even know what it was, now identify with socialism and with anti-capitalist politics. And of course, that's a very diverse movement, right? Because Bernie Sanders says he's a democratic socialist. He's more of a European style social democrat. And then you have, you know, other, you have revolutionary socialists. You have a variety. You have the DSA, the ISO, the Socialist Alternative, the Party for Socialist Liberation. You have a variety of workers' world, and all of them have been growing. And I think that it's good to have a kind of diversity on that left, especially on the non-electoral left, on the non-democratic left, because you know the larger left you have, the more you can push back and show that there is not just one alternative, there are multiple alternatives to the status quo.
Well, and Ben Dixon, I want your thoughts on this in terms of sort of more of an independent movement. I mean, I think that's been sort of one of the critiques I've seen, even from many progressives I've seen who are, you know, loyal Democrats, is the fact that it seems that many of the sort of quote-unquote progressive left movements, at least the mainstream establishment one, parts of it that get the most views on the internet or whatever, are so tied to the Democratic Party that they sort of cease to be effective. So, I mean, I don't know what you, I mean, please comment on anything Ben Norton had to say, but I wonder what you think about that general idea as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, straight to the question that you're asking, there's a challenge. There's a huge challenge facing independent movements and progressives in general, right? And that challenge is we have to organize outside of the Democratic Party so that we can hold the Democratic Party accountable. But simultaneously, we don't have a viable option right now that can organize on a national level to fight back against Trump electorally. And not just Trump, right? We got to bring it down to the state level, state by state. I mean, the GOP, they're getting constitutional amendment size majorities. You know, they're one state away from being able to call a constitutional convention. So I think we also need to take our focus off of just federal level and look at the state houses. And, you know, I don't see a party strong enough to be a viable third option. The Tea Party, I'm sorry, the Green Party, that was not a Freudian slip. The Green Party did not present in the middle of the largest rebellion against the Democratic Party that I've seen in my lifetime. They still didn't score more than 1%. So we have to both hold the Democratic Party accountable, but then also we have to be sober of our options in terms of electoral politics on the federal and local level.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marcus Farrell, get into this conversation. I mean, do you think some are arguing the Democratic Party should be abandoned? Some are saying it should be reclaimed. Some are saying, well, we should try to do both. I mean, there's a lot of different ideas about how to relate to the Democrats and what it's going to take to move progressives more to the – or move the electoral system more to the left in terms of the outcomes, policy outcomes. Where do you stand on some of this?
My personal timeline is midterms. I want to see where the movement takes us. I want to see where the Democratic Party is 2 years from now. And if it's not where, you know, our side of the house needs it to be, then I think we need to start thinking about something else. You know, unfortunately, the Green Party didn't capitalize on the momentum that they could have possibly had off of Bernie's campaign. So in order to create these credible parties, a third party would have to start organizing January 1st. Matter of fact, today, going door to door within neighborhoods that have not been touched and that the Democratic Party tends to overlook. And I mean, let's look at it. You know, in states like Florida, there was over 400,000 Latinos who didn't vote. I mean, in Arizona, the numbers were somewhere around the same numbers. What a third party could possibly do is actually go and galvanize these folks, talk to their issues while the Democrats are trying to figure their stuff out. But unfortunately, I don't think that that's happening, and I don't think they have the resources to make that happen. So I'll take the Nina Turner approach. We have to change the party from within. But in order to do that, there has to be some give and take. There has to be some negotiation that I'm not certain if the people in power right now are willing to do. I do give credit to Chuck Schumer for being one of the first sort of establishment figures to go out of his way and say, you know, let's take a look at Keith Ellison and being one of the first establishment members to actually say publicly we do need a fundamental change. But in order for that to happen, it needs to be a lot more Chuck Schumer's and a lot less Wasserman Schultz, where let's kind of sort of keep more of the same. So we're in an interesting place. I do think we'll start seeing some results by 2018, and if it doesn't change, then I think that progressive people need to start taking a look at some other options.
Well, I think that's certainly it's a good point. And I wonder, Ben Norton, if you want to reflect on this fact, because I think you mentioned the Keith Ellison piece and in general. I mean, I think politically he's good on many different issues. But when I see someone like Chuck Schumer support anything, I start to think like, okay, well, is this for real or is this some kind of okie doke at the end of the day? So, I mean, it's how do you parse the difference between sort of the substance of these sort of things and the atmospherics of it?
No, I mean, that's a good point. Like you said, I mean, I think we should be skeptical of people like Chuck Schumer, who recently in an article for Jacobin, good overview of his political career, was described as Chuck Schumer, D. Wall Street. And again, I mean, this is a difficult question for those of us, you know, on the left, for socialists. The Democratic Party has had a very long history of shifting further and further to the right in order to make up new votes. Instead of maintaining its position or even moving to the left, it's done the opposite. Like I said, I mean, for many years, leftists have called it the graveyard of social movements. So personally, I think what we should do, as Ben said and other, I mean, I understand that, you know, there is a sense of pragmatism because we are facing in a very extreme Republican Party, and it's important to resist that as well. But in many ways, the Democratic Party has fed into that for many years. The Democratic Party has allowed the Republican Party to get away with these things because it has shifted further to the right to try to take up moderate Republicans. We saw this with the Hillary Clinton campaign. She spent so much time and so many resources trying to go after moderate Republicans, and she lost not just, you know, progressives, but she lost just large sections of people, you know, people of color, migrants, young people, people in the LGBT community, who were just frustrated at her seeming inability or unwillingness to fight for any kind of progressive causes. We know from the emails not only that she spoke highly of Wall Street, but that she called she spoke very disparagingly of environmentalists and told them to get a life. You can go on the list. She listed potential VP nominees according to their race and gave them a food that matched it, like stereotypically. Like these very strange things, and the Democratic Party has become really out of touch with its supposed base. So like Marcus said, I mean, we'll see what happens in the next 2 years. It would be very interesting to see if Keith Ellison did become the chair, because, you know, Schumer might just be, you know, acting opportunistically and recognizing that he has to, you know, side with this new wing, that because it was proven right by the election, and if he wants to, you know, maintain his seat in the Senate, that he'll need to get on board with the new direction of the Democratic Party. And if the Democratic Party is going to move towards social democracy, I mean, I think that's certainly infinitely better than the neoliberal, extremely hawkish, you know, kind of policies it has now. But there's also great resistance to that inside the party. So I think it's a little too early to say exactly what will happen. But we should be watching very carefully to see, you know, if Ellison will be able to get that spot and what he'll be able to do.
Yeah, well, no, I think it's certainly a good point. And I have to say, you know, I looked at an interesting map regarding the strategy of the Clinton campaign of like counties that flipped from Obama to or Clinton or vice versa. Obviously, many more flipped from Obama to Trump than from Republicans to Clinton. And there's only two, well, there's I think four counties in like suburban areas. The two that jump out to me are Orange County, California, and Cobb County, Georgia. But it was really just a nice mediation, I thought, on how poorly that campaign strategy had actually gone, that you could just see all these counties that Trump had flipped and like almost none that Clinton had flipped. And two of them actually were like in North Carolina, where they were college towns. So, I mean, I wonder, Ben Dixon, if we learn from that the key is base mobilization, not triangulation, too smart for your own good, Robbie Mook, 34, trying to look like I'm a really smart guy strategies.
Yeah, man, I think you nailed it, and Ben Norton just nailed it, right? So while a person like me is yelling, you know, let's be pragmatic, at the same time, if the Democratic Party did not learn their lesson from this election, then they need to lose. They need to die. They need to go the way of the Whigs. Because the message of this election was a repudiation of triangulation and third wave Democrats, DLC, all of that needs to go the way. That portion of the Democratic Party has to go, because we were fooled. We were fooled by the charisma of Bill Clinton into thinking that this would work for the Democrats. And then we were fooled again by the charisma of Barack Obama thinking that this way would work for the Democrats. But unless you have someone that magnanimous and that charismatic, you cannot win, because the people are holistically rejecting this third way triangulation, becoming more and more like Republicans, because there's neither major party, let me be specific, this, not a major party representing the interests of the working class. And when I say working class, I mean intersectionally. I mean black women, trans women, I mean black people, people of color across the board that are working class, struggling from paycheck
to paycheck, even if they have a paycheck. That group of people have rejected the Clintonism, and I think if the Democratic Party has not learned their lesson, then that's shame on them.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today, but big thanks to Ben Dixon, Ben Norton, Marcus Farrell. Look all those guys up. They have a lot of great stuff all the time. That is going to do it for our time here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.